News, and that is heard Mondays at 6 p.m. here on WBAI New York 99.5 FM. As we slowly approach the 7 p.m. hour, stay tuned for Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg here on WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C. Stay tuned.
Building bridges.
Later, we're building bridges to within our lifetime to flood the streets for black and brown liberation. Gaza, 300 days of genocide, 300 days of resistance.
First, we're building the bridge to Medicare for All with Dr. Ed Weisbart, the National Board Secretary of Physicians for a National Health Program and the Vice President of the Consumers Council of Missouri. Dr. Weisbart, Ed, you said we spend more than 100 years. We spent more than 100 years trying to leap across a chasm to Medicare for All. It's time we start building the bridge across the chasm. Now that we know what's on the other side, a healthcare system based on justice, equality, fairness, prudence, and community. Well, we need a strategy to get there.
Ed, 59 years ago today, President Lyndon Johnson signed Medicare into law, a high watermark in the fight for universal health care that had started decades before and that continues to this day. What's the significance of promulgating that law, and what did it do for we the people?
Well, thanks for having me. That law, the Medicare law, 1965, transformed the healthcare landscape. It rescued seniors and people with disability from poverty. It extended their lives. People on Medicare have better life expectancies than they would if it weren't for that law. It's a hugely successful public health program. It's imperfect, but it's great. And our mission, frankly, is to improve it further, fix the things that weren't right when it was first set up, and then expand that so that everybody in the United States has it. People not just at age 65 or with disability, but people at age 55 or 45, 25, teenagers, kids. Make it a program, the same program for everybody in the country. So that's our goal. That's what we want to try to accomplish. That's what we're working on.
You know, Ed, even before we get to the issues around Medicare for All and Medicare and Medicare Advantage, one of the things that's been consistently disturbing, and I wonder how you get around this or how you analyze it, is people from the generally have the sense, the private sector is better. Even when you point out, look at Canada, look at Europe, look at most of, if not all, the Western nations and stuff who have some facsimile of a universal healthcare system, they say, no, ours is still better. Even in this form, you have to wait forever. You don't get the services you want. People die waiting there. So how do you respond still to the overall, we want universal health care and we want to take the insurance out of it. We want Medicare for all. But wait a minute, the private sector does it better.
Well, I'm a fan of the private sector for many things, and I wish that that were true in healthcare. But we have an overwhelming body of evidence that that's just not the case in healthcare. It's not a market. It doesn't follow the principles of a free market. You don't have consumers in healthcare. You just never will. Nobody wakes up in the morning and says, gee, you know, I really want a colonoscopy, or nobody having a heart attack is going to be able to stop and tell the ambulance, wait a minute, let me go shop around for the best deal on ambulances. I think there was a Groupon on ambulances this week. Nobody, it's not a market economy. And, you know, when you start introducing for-profit enterprises into healthcare, well, they do what they're designed to do. They take advantage of healthcare to make a profit. That's what they try to do. Every place that's tried that has figured out that that's really not the right way to go. And so, you know, I mean, the essence of insurance, of course, is to spread the risk so that the chances, you can't afford to pay for your heart attack personally. You can't afford to build your own burn unit. You can't afford to do, no, none of us can. So instead, we all pitch in together, you know, we as a community buy a burn unit, build a burn unit, hoping that none of us will have to use it. That's the nature of insurance. Spread it across the most people that you can, and then none of us has too big of a burden to carry financially. And the best way to do that is to take 335 million of us, is that the number? Put us all into this one program, and then it's way more efficient. The insurance industry, on the other hand, has an overhead of 15% or more in some cases. And they have to, because they advertise on TV. They have all of these people that are designed to get in the way of healthcare, to keep you from getting healthcare. They have legions of people. It's very expensive to do things that way. And Medicare itself operates with a 2% overhead and a fraction of the number of people, because it's just simple. It's just simple.
Well, doctor, let's continue the prescription for Medicare for All and how to get there. And that is looking at who then are the real attack dogs against Medicare. It's under direct assault. Who and why, as we continue to march on to win Medicare for All, we have to know who the enemy is.
Sure. So the biggest opponent, of course, is the insurance industry, because they know that health insurance is their most profitable line of business. So they don't want to have a national health insurance program. They want to be in the game. You know, which kind of takes us to the question of Medicare Advantage. When Medicare Advantage was created some 23 years ago, it was with the premise that you kind of sketched out a few minutes ago. It was with the premise that, no, government can't ever do anything right. We, the for-profit insurance industry, can do this much better. So they came to Congress and promised that they would improve the health of people in Medicare to the point that the federal government could pay these insurance companies 5% less for people in Medicare than what they pay for people in regular Medicare. And that was the promise. They said we would improve health, and by improving health for people in Medicare, we would be less expensive. So give us the business. Well, within a couple of years of the insurance industry being involved, they came back to Congress and said, hey, wait a minute, you didn't tell us. People in Medicare, they're sick. they're sick. So they actually changed the rules of the game and created all sorts of gimmicks and tricks so that now the insurance industry is paid up to 35% more than we pay for people in regular Medicare. And that's just not right. If we could take the money back from the insurance industries that are draining the Medicare trust fund, if we could get that money back from them, well, we could use that money to help us pay for hearing and vision and dentistry for everybody in Medicare, and frankly, for everybody in the country. We could use that money to make sure that there aren't any more copays or deductibles, to make sure that you can go to any doctor you want to. And that's the opposite how the insurance industry works, right? The insurance industry is prepaid by Medicare. They're paid in advance by Medicare. They're capitated by Medicare for the people that they take care of, supposedly take care of. And once they're prepaid, they treat that, as I guess they should, as their own money. They treat that as their own money, no longer is our public money. They treat it as their own money. So then they're supposed to then pay for our health care out of that money, but they view it as their money at that point. And the last thing they want to do is have to pay for our health care, because that's then something they have to pay for. They'd rather use the money to invest wherever they invest it and turn it into profits. So that means that they have their business model is based on getting in the way of healthcare. Their business model is based on telling you, no, no, you can't go to the best places in the country. You have to go to the places we pick. No, no, you can't go get your healthcare when you want to. You have to get our permission first. They delay care. They redirect care. And then they just say flat out, no, you can't. I know you think you need that. I know your doctor thinks you need that. But no, we, the all-powerful and wise insurance industry who've never met you, we know better than you and your doctor do. And no, you can't have that. Bad patient. You can't have that. And sometimes they actually will even tell you, sure, you can have this. And then you go off and get the care. And then they go back and tell the person who gave you the care that they're just not going to pay for it. Arnie Arneson just showed me a thing from a patient, a friend of hers who was given approval to get from her insurance company to get the PET scan that she needed. And on the approval form, it said, "We are approving this service, but we're not promising that we're going to pay for it."
Oh,
so
great.
They do everything they can to get in the way of care, to deny care, delay care, and just frankly not pay for it. And as a result, Americans are suffering, hurt, frankly dying, actually. There's one good example comparing Medicare Advantage to regular Medicare, to traditional Medicare, and they looked at cancer, people with cancer who went for cancer surgery, which, of course, these folks needed, and they found that people who needed cancer surgery in Medicare Advantage had to wait significantly longer than did people without Medicare Advantage who were in traditional Medicare. They had to wait longer. They ultimately couldn't even go to the National Cancer Centers of Excellence. They were much less likely to be able to go to the best places in the country. And when you put those two things together, this study from the Journal of Clinical Oncology found that people who have these kinds of cancer surgeries were more likely to die postoperatively. They, in some cases, they were twice as likely to die in the 30 days after surgery. So, you know, you tell the insurance company this information, they go, "Well, yeah, but it was cheaper." It was cheaper.
Is that the issue for Medicare Advantage? I'm still. Why is Medicare Advantage so much worse?
Yeah, so Medicare Advantage is not Medicare. It's called that, and it's advertised on TV as it's Medicare Advantage. And the insurance companies like to say, "Oh, you know, make sure you check out the latest benefits. Have you updated your Medicare?" So they like to promote it like it's Medicare, but it's not. You know, Medicare was set up in 1965, pretty simple, pretty straightforward, and that's sort of how traditional Medicare still works. We basically pay our taxes for it. We get our precious red, white, and blue Medicare card. We go see almost any doctor, almost any hospital in the country, anywhere in the country. You live in New York, but you move to, you're on vacation in Florida or whatever, and you can get health care anywhere in the country when you have Medicare. And you go see the doctor, go to the hospital, or get a test, and Medicare pays for it. It's pretty much that simple. A little more complicated, but it's pretty much that simple. Medicare Advantage, which now roughly half of people in Medicare are in, Medicare Advantage is completely different. You can't go anywhere in the country. Matter of fact, in a lot of counties, a lot of areas, you can only see maybe one in three of the doctors in your community. In traditional Medicare, you can see almost anybody. But if you've signed up for Medicare Advantage, in many places, you can only see one out of three physicians in your community. You may not be able to see any of the hospitals in your community. So they don't want you to go to, they don't want you to be able to get your health care. That's an expense. It's completely different than traditional Medicare. But because they're so overpaid, like I said, they've got these games where they're paid $140 billion a year in 2022. And that was about 35% more than what people in traditional Medicare cost. Because they have this extra money, tens of billions of dollars of money that they don't need to actually pay for health care, they're able to use that for advertisements on television, for really high commissions to insurance brokers, for the promise of dentistry and hearing and vision. And they do give some of that, but they spend probably a very small fraction of that extra subsidy on hearing, vision, and dentistry. And, you know, they put the ads up that make it sound like, you know, you're going to have dentistry. Well, we know that people in Medicare Advantage have a much harder time getting dental care than do people in traditional Medicare if they have Medigap. We know that. We know that although it sounds like you have a dental benefit, they may tell you, well, but we're only going to pay for 25% of that kind of dental care. You know, they don't pay for stuff. And then finding a dentist in your community who takes the dental policy from Medicare Advantage is pretty hard. So it's bait and switch, right? It's bait and switch. They advertise all these extra benefits and they don't actually provide them.
So to win Medicare for all, we must reclaim Medicare from the profiteers. How do we do that?
Hello. Well, that was fun. So I guess that was the magic word, huh? So how do we do that? Well, it's a three-part strategy. The first is make Medicare Advantage corporations do what they claim they do. Make them do what they promised they would do back in 2003 when they were created. Make them do what they still today claim they do. They claim that they lower the cost of health care by improving health outcomes. That's what they claim. Okay, so the first part of the strategy is do that, Medicare Advantage corporations. That means we should not have to subsidize you. Give us back that $140 billion because you said you could do this for less. You didn't say you needed a subsidy. So the first part of the strategy is take back that $140 billion and let the Medicare Advantage companies win their case by actually making care better. And, you know, we all know that's a bunch of hooey. We all know that's a bunch of hooey. There's no magic that Medicare Advantage companies can somehow coordinate care better than your doctor already does. They're not going to be able to save money by doing any of that. That's why they demanded the extra money. That's why they're doing that. So the first part of the strategy is, okay, do what you said you're going to do and lower costs by improving care, which means your subsidies are over and done today. No more of those. The second part of the strategy is we have to improve traditional Medicare. And people who are in Medicare Advantage may be suffering from these delays of care and denials of care and taking away their choice of doctor and hospital. But they do get some perks from being in Medicare Advantage. They do have this modest dental benefit, which, as I said, isn't that great. They do have some eyeglass coverage. They do have some hearing aid coverage. They have a maximum out-of-pocket so that the copays and deductibles are limited to something like $8,000 a year. So there is some stuff in there. So take the extra money that the Medicare Advantage corporations are rating us for and put that into improving traditional Medicare. So that's really important as the second part of the strategy, because if you did actually impact the business model for Medicare Advantage and they did cut back from the marketplace, you would want to make sure that the people who are in Medicare Advantage today didn't suffer, didn't lose any of the benefits that they're getting today. And frankly, it's a good thing to do anyway, because You know, it's hard for me to decide who doesn't need to have eyeglasses if they can't see right. That's hard for me to say, no, no, your teeth aren't as important as somebody else. You know, it's everybody in the country, certainly everybody in Medicare, should have hearing, vision, dentistry, be protected from high costs, all of that stuff. So the first part of the strategy is tell Medicare Advantage companies they have to do what they said they can do and cut off their subsidies. Second part is protect the people in Medicare Advantage if they go back to traditional Medicare by making sure that those benefits are still available to them, hearing, vision, dentistry, and a few other things. Then the third part of the strategy is if we did those first two things, well, then why wouldn't we give that improved form of Medicare to everybody? It would be a far superior insurance than what almost anybody in the country has from their employer. So make the transition and make sure that everybody in the country can have that.
Well, I have two critically important questions. One, do you make house calls? No. We are speaking with Dr. Ed Weisbart with Physicians for National Health Program, and I've been looking for a good doctor. But I also want to know, I've got a miserable insurance company, United Healthcare, and then there's Blue Cross Blue Shield, who've erected these, what you call, cruel barriers to care and are laughing all the way to the bank. So what do we do to rest away from the United Healthcares and the Blue Cross Blue Shields to get to Medicare for all as well?
Well, I think it starts with exposing them. I mean, we have to come be united in this as a people. When you are trying to get your health care and you run into some of these roadblocks and United, for example, as you said, doesn't let you get what you need, it's really easy to think it's your fault. It's really easy to think, oh, I'm in this weird circumstance, or, gee, I just don't know how to navigate. No, it's not your fault. It's the business model of these insurance companies. So the way we wrest it away is demand from Congress that they put in the accountability, that they put in the requirements, and, you know, frankly, to advocate for Medicare for all, because that's the solution to getting the insurance industry away from here. But the way to do that, I think, is first of all, we have to prove to the American people that actually we do know how to run a really, really good insurance product, you know, and make Medicare sing, you know, make Medicare into the humming machine that it was designed to be. It operates with a 2% overhead. Insurance companies operate with a 15% overhead. So make Medicare it really hum and sing so that everybody who has it just adores it. And then, you know, I think the popular demand for something that good, everybody would look at that and go, well, why can't I have that? You know, well, you can have that. Tell Congress you want that. Have them co-sponsor the Medicare for All legislation.
What's the prescription, doctor, for traveling the road to reach Medicare for All, which has never been more important? There's a National Day of Action, isn't there?
Yes, actually. So the group that I spend most of my time with, Physicians for a National Health Program, you know, we're a nonprofit, nonpartisan group, and we just think the strategy that I spelled out to you is really, really important. And the piece that we're really kind of trying to amplify right now is exposing the dangers, the hazards, the outrageousness of Medicare Advantage. And so to that end, we've been organizing a National Day of Action all around the country. We want communities to gather together in some way, speak out against the Medicare Advantage corporations that are hurting us. So that's September 30th. So September 30th, there are going to be events in many parts of the country, and people should keep an eye out for that and get engaged. And you can learn about that by going to our organization's website. That's Physicians for a National Health Program, or PNHP.org. And if you go there, you can find it. But the most direct way is to go to PNHP.org/MAPetition, Medicare Advantage Petition. So if you go to PNHP.org/MAPetition, you'll be able to sign our petition against Medicare Advantage. It's a pretty simple petition. It says, we, the undersigned, demand Congress and the President protect Medicare beneficiaries by cracking down on insurance company abuses and significantly improving the traditional public Medicare program. So if you go to pnhp.org/MAPetition, you can sign our petition. And if you get onto that website, we'll also then have your email address if you like, and we can keep you apprised as the September 30th Day of Action starts to roll out more across the country.
So on the Day of Action, do we take over insurance companies?
Well, you know, it's important to match your strategy
like Occupy
with your
Wall
power.
Street?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, every community will do the thing that they think they have the power to accomplish.
So then let's talk about how we build this movement. I in the few minutes that we have left, there was a point when Bill Clinton was running for office where the number one issue that was defined by the electorate was health care. Now, the number one issue, and this seems to be true for the Republicans and the Democrats, have been whipped into the frenzy of xenophobia and say immigration is the critical issue. Oh, my God. Oh, infuriating. So how do we build this movement back of seniors and physicians and students and people with disabilities and everybody else who cares about Medicare, about health care justice? How do we build this movement and put Medicare for All back on the table and make it indispensable and not be distracted with Obamacare or the like?
Well, I think the first thing in that is to give people the hope that it's possible. You know, I think that's one of the hardest pieces is when you think this is something off in the future. I don't know what I can do. The first thing to do when you feel frustrated is to take action, get engaged. So that's where the Day of Action comes in place. So start getting involved. You know, sign the petition. Tell your friends about this stuff. Get engaged. You know, learn more, read more. I think when people understand that it's possible, that there's actually a strategy, that there are many ways to get engaged and to raise your voice, I think we start to see more of a connection and people start to feel more more like it's more something where they can engage with more easily. But all the issues that you've raised are connected. You know, every piece of this, you know, take you know, what's going on with the military, take the environment, take any issue that you want to pick. And it's all related to our fragile and dysfunctional democracy. So, but the thing that's different about healthcare is we all use it almost every day, right? Anybody who takes medications takes their pill like every day, sometimes several times a day. We all go to the doctor every few months. We all wind up going to the hospital every few years. This is something that's not theoretical. This is something that's happening to other people. This is all of us. So I think there's a tremendous opportunity for us all to engage. And like I said, the first step right now for people would be to go to pnhp.org/MAPetition and find a way to engage on September 30th.
Well, Dr. Ed Weisbart, Secretary of Physicians for a National Health Program, you made the prescription relatively easy, and it is a matter of life and death. Hours. So go to that website, get on board with Physicians for a National Health Program and fight for Medicare for All. And the issue here is it is about democracy. It is about democracy. Health justice is about the maintenance of a democracy, and it's a matter of us breaking out of our individual silos. Medicare for All, yes. Medicare Advantage, hell no. We come together, we build that movement, and under the leadership of Physicians for a National Health Program. Dr. Ed Weisbart, thank you so much. We'll have you back again because it's a matter of life and breath or death. It's been great speaking with you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, now, life and death, my goodness. Gaza, 300 days of genocide, 300 days of resistance. We're off to flood the streets within our lifetime, committed to dismantling Zionism and for Palestinian people, colonized people, to resist the Zionist project. Resistance is existence. We'll hear first from Nardine Keshwani, a principal leader of Within Our Lifetime, using the people's microphone, because what do you know? Once again, they were denied a permit for sound. But we will not be deterred. We're off to flood the streets for Gaza, for black, for brown, for Palestinian liberation.
Repeat after me.
Repeat after me.
We are using the people's mic.
We are using the people's mic.
To do political education.
To do political education.
And explain why.
And explain why.
We stand here today.
We stand here today.
We are flooding Brooklyn.
We are flooding Brooklyn.
For black and Palestinian liberation.
For black.
Was murdered in cold blood. In her own home.
In her own home.
This happened
Thousands of Palestinians in Gaza
are being held in a concentration camp.
So we are going to be crossing the street now and joining the body of the demonstration on this extraordinarily hot day, as it also looks like there may be an extraordinary thunderstorm looming in the distance. So here we are, and this looks like where the demonstrators are gathering. I've just been handed Flood Brooklyn for Black and Palestinian Liberation, Gaza, 300 days of genocide. Actually, it's 301 days of genocide now. Why don't you tell us what we're at the downtown Brooklyn Mall. People are gathering, a number of the protesters who are unrelenting in their cause for the Palestinian people have expressed their wariness, but they're here. So you are here. Tell us who you are and what the major message of this 301 day of genocide and ethnocide throughout all of the historic landmass of Palestine is about.
Absolutely. So I'm a member of Within Our Lifetime. And I believe that, you know, the word you use, unrelenting, is 100% correct, especially considering the weather right now. You know, it's unbearably hot, but we still have hundreds of people who are coming out in support of Palestinian liberation, you know, taking time out of their day for 301 days in a row to flood Brooklyn for Gaza, to flood New York for Gaza. And I think that it speaks to the fact that, you know, the people here really recognize that whatever we're enduring and whatever we're facing, whether it's the weather, whether it's, you know, police brutality, and whatever it may be, it's not a fraction of what the people in Palestine are enduring. And now, you know, as this war, as this genocide, I should say, escalates and spreads out, as Israel, you know, has conducted multiple acts of severe aggression against Lebanon, against Yemen, against Iran, and most recently, you know, continually massacre after massacre against the people in Gaza, in the West Bank, and all of Palestine. I think that the people here recognize the vital importance of our role here within the United States, within the belly of the beast, the, you know, the heart of the empire that is funding this genocide, that is arming the Zionist state to essentially act without impunity. While, you know, many people continue to, and specifically people within the U.S. security apparatus continue to push this line that they're negotiating towards a ceasefire, we see that Israel recently assassinated the primary negotiator for
Ismail Haniyeh. Right. So what is the particular significance of that? I mean, he was one of the prime negotiators dealing with the hostage. He's the political voice of Hamas. He's been respected, admired actually around the world for decades for his intrepid commitment to a free, free Palestine. And now we have the assassination in another country's country. Your thoughts on how this, what escalates, how this, what it means, what is the positioning of the U.S., who clearly sanctioned this and is now also sending additional armaments and ships to the Mediterranean and so on to enlarge the war?
Despite the U.S.'s claims, Anthony Blinken's claims to have been totally unaware of, you know, Israel's plans to commit this assassination, we know that the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, was in Congress a week prior, receiving a standing ovation from our representatives and our politicians.
Or the representatives.
The representatives. Because they're certainly not representing us nor the will of the people, the majority of which do want this genocide to end. What I would say is that this very clearly sends a message that we have had no misunderstanding of for the past 10 months, and certainly the Palestinian people have had no misunderstanding of for the past 75 years, which is that Israel's goal is genocide. As much as they may insist that they are, you know, trying to negotiate towards a ceasefire, that they're trying to, you know, end this quote-unquote war, this aggression, What we see very obviously is that the intentions of the Israeli state, the intentions of this settler outpost of the U.S. Empire, is to commit a genocide and to see this genocide through. They have no interest in negotiations, in diplomacy, in ceasing aggression. In fact, their intentions very obviously are to expand the aggression to the entire region and to any regional adversaries to both Israel and the United States, at whatever cost that may incur both, to the people of the region. And I would say that we, have to act with a little more clarity with regards to the fact that, one side, the side of the U.S. and Israel, are clearly not interested in a ceasefire, no matter what they're telling us. They're only interested in continued aggression, hostilities, and the maintenance of this genocide. We just saw this report come out. Recently there was this report that came out of for lack of a better word, a concentration camp, a torture camp, where the Israeli occupation forces have been taking people from Gaza, specifically men from Gaza, and a report has come out that they are brutally torturing them in ways that are incomprehensible. They're raping them. They're using sexual violence. They're cutting off their limbs. There were two prisoners who were raped to death, who were sodomized to death by Israeli prison guards. And when Israel arrested 9 of these prison guards out of fear of international reaction to it, what we saw was a large number of settlers in the Zionist colony, essentially staging a coup, staging like their own version of January 6th, essentially for the right to rape Palestinian prisoners, to rape Palestinian men, which they believe and they consider to be, something worth fighting for, worth defending. This is not only obviously unacceptable and sick and twisted, but at the same time, again, it underscores the fact that these genocidal hostilities and this genocidal sentiment is something that is being defended by a large swath of people within Israel, and the pressure. Yeah, I mean, any pressure to the alternative has so far been unsuccessful, both within that state and within our state. We've been unsuccessful in stopping a single bullet or a single bomb from being shipped to Israel. In fact, the genocide is only escalating, and it, reaffirms what we've understood for a very long time, that this is not a state to negotiate with, to make peace with, to normalize relations with. This is a genocidal entity who is hell-bent on ethnically cleansing the land of Palestine of its indigenous people.
And the march is moving out now, so I don't want to hold you up more. And you are with?
Within our lifetime.
Thanks for speaking
to
us.
Thank you so much. Have a great
time. As a former political prisoner, I'm here with Susan Rosenberg, who the last time we really spent time together was actually in Cuba with the Benson Amos Brigade, yeah. And a lot of water under the bridge since then. Your thoughts and, of course, what brings you here today, and the two messages that have been circulating are, of course, Free, Free Palestine, but in conjunction with that, the murderer, again, a young African-American woman, Sonya Massey. So your thoughts on what brings you here today and with your stark blue keffiyeh?
Well, thanks. I think what brought me here or brings me here is what is bringing millions of people all over the world to stop the genocidal war against the Palestinian people that Israel is waging, and with complete United States support. So, and for me, settler colonialism has been something I have been opposed to for my whole life, whether it was settler colonialism in South Africa and here. So for me, what's going on in Palestine and what's going on in the United States are twins of a united system.
One of the things that I can't help but ask, so are we at a different kind of period where, in terms of, here we are, New York, Brooklyn, we're in a climate where we have a revival of a kind of UAC, the Virginia Fox committee in Congress on Education and Labor, which is calling Sean Fain from the UAW before it. I'm just interested what you think that this period portends in terms of repression for people who are fighting against settler colonialism.
I think it's just going to escalate.
Isn't it extenuate?
It's going to escalate and escalate, and that is what is happening. There are blacklists going on for people around Palestine in all sectors of the society. Legal aid, Hollywood, you name it, where people who are taking positions to defend the Palestinian right of resistance or just to stop the war and for ceasefire, you're being labeled and targeted. I've been in CUNY, and it's been a complete scene, terrible scene about what's gone on. Both
are you teaching in CUNY?
I have been,
and I'm a graduate from CUNY Law School. Yeah.
So I think I think this is a moment in. Look, the institutions of the society are in a total chaos, but meanwhile, militarism is taking the high ground, whether that's in Palestine or in other places.
At the same time. Since we mentioned CUNY Law School and stuff, the demonstration today has this vibrant, remarkable young woman, Nardine, with Not In Our Lifetime, who is unrelenting in her activity. And most of the people here today are young people of a very diverse grouping. Right. So your thoughts and enthusiasm.
She was in my class.
Ah.
And when before she graduated, and she was a brilliant, incredible student, and that was a course about prisons and human rights. So I agree with you. And the youth, the young people, the movement that's emerging, the student movement, but not just the student movement, and it's Palestinian-led, which really I think is so crucial.
And how would you look at this at time now? And there's a great deal of consciousness that this is a movement against settler colonialism. And during the 60s and 70s, where all of South Asia and Africa were really leading the movements to decolonize their country. So politically, where do you think we are, or what's the legacy? The legacy for you, indeed, from the 60s and 70s to the exuberance and activism of these young people here today fighting, still self-determination and and settler colonialism.
Well, that's such a big question.
Yeah, it is.
I think the legacy, I think anti-imperialism then and anti-imperialism now, there's a link between them, and the right to self-determination and the struggle for human rights. And I think the legacy from that earlier period about naming and targeting white supremacy as central to what the United States history has been and is currently enacting against its own population and everywhere that it is looking is something that we understood then. And I think it's being much more sharply understood. It's also true that Trump and the whole movement of white supremacy and fascism is also let me leave it at that. I'll just leave it.
You can, Susan Rosenberg, thanks. It's good to see you again. Good to have you here. For all of our progressive rallies against what? Ethnocide, genocide, neocolonialism against neocolonialism. Well, that was from Flood the Streets, Not In Our Lifetime, For a Free, Free Palestine. Oh, yes. Existence is resistance for the Palestinian people. 300 days plus of genocide, 300 days of resistance to genocide. We've been off to Flood the Streets with Within Our Name. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
Okay, Nash.
And we continue to seek with Building Bridges to educate, agitate, and organize to empower the disenfranchised and certainly no more genocide in our name, not another nickel, not another dime, no more money for Israel's crime. Thanks for letting us into your house, and keep on keeping on. I'm Mimi Rosenberg. And we do build bridges.
For the better part of a century, Hour of the Wolf has given WBAI listeners the opportunity to listen to many of the great classic voices of science fiction and fantasy literary luminaries, ranging from Octavia Butler.
I had God charge Martha with creating a better human species.
To Frank Herbert.
Kabbalah is a person who can be many places at once.
From Ken Liu. To Ursula K. Le Guin.
Physiologically, for 25, 26 days a month, they are no gender. They are ungendered beings. And then they go into heat.
We also bring you many of the up-and-coming creators in the field, as well as genre movie reviews. In the past, you had to visit Morning Twilight or Witching Hours to hear the show, but now you can find host Jim Freund with new guests and classic recordings as part of WBAI's Art Strip, Monday nights at 9 p.m. Join us.
Does the diversity of WBAI's staff, programming, and LSB compare with the demographics of our region? That's what the Committee of Inclusion is going to examine. Join us on Monday by Zoom at 7 p.m. By phone, use any Zoom number like 646-558-8656, 646-558-8656, and the meeting ID is 922-457-2995 or WBAI-LSB-995. That's 922-457-2995. The passcode is like all frequencies.